chapters 11 and 12 of the Gospel of John are transitional chapters. We've observed at the conclusion of the 10th chapter that John, the evangelist, the writer of this Gospel, has set a marker for us that indicates that he has brought to a conclusion a particular aspect of his gospel, of his writing. He began, after his introduction, with a reference to John the Baptist, who was a messenger sent from God to prepare the way for the Messiah. And at the end of chapter 10, we observed that again, John the Baptist is referred to by his followers, who recalled that everything that he had said, all his testimony concerning Jesus, was true. John has unfolded for us different aspects of the life of Jesus, things that he had done during his public ministry that had testified to who he was, that he was indeed the messenger sent from God, the Messiah, the anointed one from God. More than that, that he was the Son of God in a deeper sense than many of the Jews would have understood. Yes, they understood that in one sense the Messiah was the Son of God, just as all Israelites are children of God. But in a very particular way, the Messiah is the Son of God, for he is divinity. He is God, God incarnate. John has made abundant reference to the unity between the Father and the Son, and to Jesus' claim to being the Son and having this unity. It was the main catalyst for his opponents, the religious leaders of his day, to set against him in an attempt to kill him. He was blaspheming to make himself equal with God, and in their minds, in opposition to God. In the 13th chapter of the Gospel, we begin to focus in upon the last few days of the life of Jesus before his crucifixion. And in these intervening chapters then, the 11th and the 12th chapters, we move from the argument concerning who Jesus is with a shift of focus to what Jesus does. Now certainly we can't be as clear-cut as that. We've already seen evidence of what Jesus does, what his mission was for. But certainly in this shift of focus, there is a greater degree of clarity as to the exact mission that the Messiah was coming on. And it is perhaps condensed and solidified, as it were, in the story before us this morning, in the resurrection of Lazarus from the dead. There are three particular things that I want you to note from this story. And the first is the reality of death. The reality of death. Death is commonplace. Death is all around us, though to some degree in our modern society it's been sanitized. There was a time that most of the children here would have frequently encountered death of family and friends. Perhaps most of you here, the younger ones at least, have never actually seen a dead body. And yet, 100 years ago, that would not have been the case. You would have seen many dead bodies of all ages. Death has, to a large degree, been sort of cleaned up for us. And at times, even though death is all around us, we can forget about it because it's not as prominent as perhaps it was in past ages. But nevertheless, death is a certain reality. Death has come into the world, and every one of us at some point or another in our lives have to confront death, the death of others, and ultimately our own deaths. Death is a reality in this world. And death was a reality in the world of Jesus. Death was a reality in the world of Martha and Mary and Lazarus. This brother and sisters who lived in Bethany, just slightly less than a two-mile journey from outside Jerusalem. Death would have been familiar to them. And sickness would have been a concern for them. And so, as soon as Lazarus falls ill, Mary and Martha send a message to Jesus. Lazarus is ill. Lazarus could die. Jesus at this time is many, many miles away. He's up in the region of Galilee, where he had first encountered John baptizing. Perhaps 150 kilometers away. By the time the message gets to Jesus, and Jesus eventually turns up in the village of Bethany, Lazarus is dead. Lazarus is really dead. Lazarus is so dead that his body is beginning to smell. Well, that's a polite way of putting it. He stank. It was the practice in those days to put spices and perfumes on the body of a dead person before it was buried in an attempt to cover up the stench. This had been done to Lazarus. He had had a sheet soaked in spices put over him, folded from his feet, up over his head, down to his feet, tied around his ankles, tied around his face. And there he was, laid to rest in a cave. Perhaps a natural cave, possibly a man-made cave carved out of the rock. A stone had been placed over the entrance to that burial chamber. But Lazarus stank. He was really dead. 4 days he's been dead. Now, this may seem to us to be trivial in a sense. Of course, you know, 4 days dead is just as dead as 1 day dead. But to the Jews of this day, many of them believed that the spirit still sort of hovered around the place for about 3 days after a person had died, observing the mourning that was taking place. And in a strange way, a person wasn't really dead until after that time. There was always, in a sense, a possibility that something different could happen. The outcome might be different. And this accounts for Jesus' comments to his disciples. Mary and Martha think that the illness that Lazarus is suffering from is, or at least has the possibility of, leading to death. Jesus says, this illness does not lead to death. He clarifies, though, by saying it's for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. In other words, he's not necessarily saying it doesn't lead to any kind of death at all, but that ultimately Lazarus will not end up dead. We're told that Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, and that it was, interestingly enough, because of his love for Martha and her sister and Lazarus, that when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place that he was. Doesn't that seem strange? Here is a man whom he loves, with sisters whom he loves, who is sick, possibly dying. And because he loves them, Jesus stays away. Martha, as soon as she sees Jesus, says, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Mary, as soon as she sees Jesus, says exactly the same thing. If you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Mary and Martha both knew that Jesus could have healed their brother of his sickness that led to death. Indeed, the people themselves around say, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying? Everyone there understood that with the powers that Jesus had already displayed in the world, there was the potential for him to have saved Lazarus. And yet he deliberately stayed away. Why? Because he wanted the people to know the reality of death and the reality of Lazarus's death. You know, Jesus could not have gotten there in time to save Lazarus anyway. And Mary and Martha know that. Their comments when they encounter Christ are not criticisms of him for his delay. They don't necessarily know that he deliberately delayed his coming. They've been waiting. Presumably they've been waiting 6 days. Because Jesus set out on his journey as soon as he hears or knows by divine inspiration that our friend has fallen asleep. But I'm going to wake him up. He's died, but I'm going to him now. 4 days from that point, but he's already delayed, you see, 2 days, so it's 6 days. But anything could have happened in those 6 days. The journey could have been more difficult than anticipated. They may have had to take a detour because of problems on the road or because of bandits in the vicinity that he was travelling. There could have been a whole host of reasons why Jesus would have taken 6 days to do the journey rather than 4. But either way, he would have been late, even if he'd left immediately. Lazarus would have been 2 days dead. And there's the point, you see. He would have been 2 days dead. Which to us is as dead as 4 days dead, but to a Jew wasn't as dead as 4 days dead. Reminds me of a scene out of The Princess Bride, where there's a kind of a witch doctor fellow who is brought a dead body to resurrect life again, and he presses down on the chest of this dead body, and a bit of breath comes out through the mouth, and there's a groan, and the fellow says, he's not all dead, he's just mostly dead. Well, that was the kind of way that many of the Jews thought at this time. They're only mostly dead for the first 3 days. They're all dead after that. They're really dead after that. Jesus' delay was to ensure that when he arrived, Lazarus wasn't just mostly dead in the minds of the people. Lazarus was all dead. Lazarus was really dead. He doesn't want them to have any doubts about what he is about to do. He is going to ensure that this illness does not ultimately lead to death, but does ultimately lead to the glory of God and the glory of the Son of God. And he also wants to ensure that the miracle that he knows he is about to perform has its full effect in the hearts and lives of those he loves. Of Martha and Mary and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Because he loved them, he delayed. Because he loves his disciples, he has delayed. But when he hears about the death, he embarks on the 4-day journey from where he is down to Bethany. So that he can perform this miracle. This miracle that is intended to be a blessing to those who watch, to those who observe. That's why he says, Lazarus has died, and for your sake, I'm glad that I was not there. Yes. Jesus would acknowledge what Mary says and what Martha says. If he had been there, their brother would not have died. If he had been there, Jesus would have intervened. And for the sake of Mary and Martha and Lazarus and his disciples, he is glad that he was not there, because he wants them to know the reality of death. And he wants them to observe his power over death. But we're jumping ahead of ourselves by going there. So let us first go to my second point. The first being that death is real. And Lazarus' death was real. The second point that we need to observe is that death is abnormal. Death is abnormal. We expect it. We expect people to die. It's happened, at the very least, for 6,000 years. Every person has died except two. And no, I'm not referring to Jesus. Two of the Old Testament characters were taken from this earth without dying. And so we get this impression that death is normal. But it's not. Death is abnormal. Look at Jesus' reaction to what is going on here in Bethany. Martha comes, speaks to him. Mary comes, falls down before him in an emotional outburst of weeping. Here are Jews all around. Some of them will be professional mourners, wailing at the tops of their voices. But many have come out from Jerusalem to console and to comfort and to be with Mary and Martha in their distress. It's obvious that Mary and Martha were prominent citizens in the region, and almost certainly very wealthy citizens in the region. We haven't come to it yet, but in the 12th chapter we have the incident of Mary washing Jesus' feet with expensive ointment. Very expensive ointment. And so there's this whole vast crowd of people in Bethany who have come out to weep and to mourn the death of Lazarus along with Mary and Martha. And Jesus sees all of this. And we're told he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. Again, in verse 38, the same phrase is used. Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. The Greek word that is translated by our English words, deeply moved, has been to a large degree softened in this English translation. The idea is one of anger. Indeed, Don Carson goes on as far as to say that Jesus was outraged. Why? Who with? When Jesus saw all the weeping, and as he approached the tomb, and John records for us that he was angry in his spirit. Why was he angry? With whom was he angry? Is he angry with Mary? Because of her outburst of weeping? A lack of faith in him, perhaps, being signified by it? Is he angry at the people, at the professional wailers and their hypocritical mourning? Probably neither of those things. Rather, Jesus is angered by the reality of the circumstances he's in. He is faced with the death of a loved one. That ought never to have happened. And I don't mean it ought never to have happened because he ought to have been there and healed him of his sickness. I mean it ought never to have happened because the sickness should never have been there. It ought never to have happened because death ought never to have reigned in the world. It ought never to have happened because Adam should never have disobeyed God and brought the curse of God upon mankind, the death curse of God. You see, Jesus stands there before this tomb of a beloved disciple and witnesses the mourning of two women who are dear to him. And he sees the weeping and the wailing of a people for whom death is so natural, when to him it is abnormal. It's an invasion of the creation that he had made by the word of his power perfect, so that he could pronounce it is very good. But he looks on at this scene and he says, this isn't very good. This should never have happened. You see, his view of this world is so different from ours. We look at things around us and we just accept them. They're so normal to us. Death is so normal to us. Sickness is so normal to us. Even sin, fighting and warfare, killing and rape, stealing. All these things, they go on around us, they appear in the newspapers, and they're just normal. But they weren't normal for Jesus. They are the abnormal effects of man's rebellion against God. And it ought never to have been. And Jesus then is angered. He's outraged by this reality that ought never to have been. Then we have those words, the shortest verse in the Bible. Not that John wrote 35 just before it. Jesus wept. Jesus wept on other occasions too. We think of the time that he wept over Jerusalem, because the people were like sheep without a shepherd. It was the same reason, you see. A world living abnormally, in his view, from his perspective. And it causes him to be angered. And it also causes him to weep. And that takes us then to the third point that we must make. We've seen the reality of death. We've observed the abnormality of death. And in the third place, we observe the reversal of death. Lazarus is really dead. Jesus says, move the stone away. And Martha says, says to him, "Lord, by this time there'll be an odour. He has been dead 4 days. His body will have begun to deteriorate, to rot. There's going to be a stench if you open the tomb now. Can't you weep and mourn the death of Lazarus without moving the stone? Without inflicting us all with this stench?" Jesus has already asked some significant questions of Martha. He's told her that her brother will rise again. And Martha's acknowledged, "Yes, I know. I'm not a Sadducee." The Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. She believed. "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And Jesus says to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. And whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." And he asks her, "Do you believe this?" And she acknowledges, "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." She believes that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, we mustn't misunderstand what she's saying. Within the statements that we find, the testimonies of the disciples concerning the identity of Jesus, there's much misunderstanding. When Martha says, "I believe that you are the Christ," then we take it as it stands. She understands that he is the Messiah. When she says, "the Son of God," we mustn't think in the terms that we readily understand that phrase. I don't think that she has come to the point of understanding that Jesus is in fact God incarnate. The second person of the Trinity clothed in human flesh. That he is in reality the Son of God, the Son of God the Father, in that sense. But he is the Son of God, just as the Messiah who was to come was to be the Son of God, just as Israel is the Son of God, in that sense. She understands, you see, something of who Jesus is, but she hasn't grasped the entire reality of who Jesus is. But what Jesus is about to do is going to be a big step on the way to demonstrating who he is. He is the resurrection and the life. He is the source of resurrection life. He who once spoke a word and the worlds came into existence. He who once called forth every creature of air and sea and earth and caused them to live and move in this world. He who formed mankind out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. He is the one who stands before Martha as he speaks these words. And he is the one who can breathe new life into that which has become dead in trespasses and sins. And he is going to demonstrate this reality by this incredible miracle. as he stands before the grave of Lazarus, the stone having been moved away, he calls out with a loud voice and he says, "Lazarus, come out." And at the entrance of the cave, shuffling and hopping and jumping with his hands and feet and face bound and covered in this spice-filled cloth, is a man, living, not dead. "Unbind him. Let him go," Jesus says. Can you imagine the scene? It must have been incredible for this vast crowd of people to have watched and listened, heard those words, and then with eyes fixed on that opening in the rock, wondered, what's going to happen? And those who had prepared him for burial must have thought, how on earth is he going to come out anyway? And there, hopping and shuffling, bound in these grave clothes, a man who has been dead for 4 days appears. A man who should be stinking from death appears. Lazarus was given life. Lazarus was raised from the dead. The power of death in the body of Lazarus was reversed. And that which had begun to decay, to rot, was now clean and healthy. We have no account of Lazarus's testimony. If this had happened today, there would be big bucks being paid, or at least offered to Lazarus, for his story of his very near-death experience. But there's nothing. We don't know anything about what Lazarus had experienced. But we know that he was brought back to life. Now we know that from the very point that Lazarus struggled out of that tomb, he began to die all over again. And one day he would be buried, perhaps in that same tomb. But you know, we're only talking about days, weeks, at the most months, before Lazarus will be able to witness one of the greatest events in all of history. That he who once was dead and now lives would witness the death of the one who raised him from the dead, would witness the crucifixion of Christ, would witness his resurrection from the dead. I imagine, though there is certainly no testimony in the scriptures to this, that Lazarus must have been very thankful to have had that opportunity, to have gone to his own death, not only looking forward to one who would save him, but to be able to go to his death looking back at the fullness of the reality of the salvation that Jesus brings. Not to be an Old Testament believer looking forward to the cross as he once was, as he lay on his sick bed and finally breathed his last, trusting in the one who was to come as the Redeemer of Israel. But later, how long later, we don't know. He would perhaps lie on the sick bed again and come to the point of breathing his last breath, but doing so looking back at the fullness of what Christ had done. This illness is for the glory of God. And because Jesus loved Lazarus, he waited. And for the sake of Lazarus and the other disciples, Jesus was glad that he was not there in Bethany, so that you may believe. You see, the physical raising of Lazarus from the dead in Bethany on this occasion points to the spiritual life that Jesus is able to restore to the human race, to everyone who will believe in him. He is the one who is able to reverse death. Not just physical death, but spiritual death. Separation from God. He is the one who came on a mission into this world in order to reunite God and man, who had become separated because of sin, under the curse of death because of transgression. And the miracle of raising Lazarus from the dead is intended to teach us that Jesus Christ is the one who can give every one of us life. Life that goes beyond physical death for eternity. And a life that would come by the death of the Creator. Jesus, as the disciples themselves point out, in going to Bethany to perform this miracle, is putting himself in the middle of a lion's den. He's left Jerusalem because the religious leaders are trying to do away with him, to kill him. And he comes back in order to perform this greatest of his miracles, pointing to the purpose of his coming. And as soon as he performs this miracle, we read that some of the Jews who were there in Bethany rush off back to Jerusalem and tell the Pharisees what Jesus has done. And the Pharisees decide that enough has happened and it's time for Jesus to die. But in the midst of all of this, Caiaphas says an interesting thing. Not understanding really what he is saying, he prophesies concerning the death of Christ. In his mind, presumably what he is saying is better for Jesus to be killed than for him to be the instigator of a rebellion that brings the wrath of Rome upon us so that the nation perishes. Well, in a sense, that's exactly what happened in 70 AD. But at this point in time, he says, it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. And John comments, he did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. It is by Jesus' own death that resurrection life is possible for those who believe in him. It is by Jesus' death on the cross, in which he paid the price for sin and therefore lifted the curse of those who believe in him, that life could be restored to those who are dead in trespasses and sins. It is only through the physical and spiritual death of Jesus, the Son of God, forsaken, separated from the Father. It is only by that means that the world could be saved, that the world could receive life. And it is for this purpose that Jesus came into the world. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? Jesus asked that of Martha before Lazarus was raised. Now, we know the story. It's so familiar to us that we read through it and we go through it, and it doesn't affect us. Familiarity breeds contempt, the proverb tells us. We need to get beyond the familiarity of passages like this and realize the message that they send to us. See in this story the source of resurrection life and believe in the source. Believe in Jesus, for it is only through faith in him that you will live.